Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure to be joined by Ed Haslam, the author of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, the story of an underground medical laboratory, published in soft cover by the Wordsworth Press, copyright 1995. Ed, welcome back to our airwaves.
Thank you.
We've been speaking about the political heritage, not only of the city of New Orleans, in which many of the events in this book take place, but also Tulane University. City of New Orleans is America's commercial gateway in many ways to Latin America. It also has very profound national security connections because of that. Tulane Medical School, or Tulane University, and its medical school likewise, very closely connected with American commercial and national security interests in Latin America. We've also been speaking about Dr. Alton Oxner, an individual very prominent in the history of New Orleans, prominent in the history of Tulane University, prominent in the history of American medicine, also with very strong connections to the business community in this country, the Latin American elite, to the national security establishment, and also a major reactionary political animal. We've been discussing Alton Oxner's sponsorship or work with what in effect was his political godchild, the Information Council of the Americas, an alleged intelligence front that certainly was involved with arranging an interview in which Lee Harvey Oswald discusses his alleged communist background, his defection to the Soviet Union, that painted Oswald red in the eyes of the American people. Many assassination researchers have felt that that led many liberals to cover up, in fact, many people to cover up the assassination of President Kennedy for fear it might start a Third World War. We have been discussing Guy Bannister's detective agency, Ed. That was located at a dual address, 531 Lafayette Place and 544 Camp Street. Oswald's 544 Camp Street literature. Oswald, by the way, we should not fail to mention, was the only member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. That was an interesting organization for Oswald to be the only member of, considering his connections with Guy Bannister. Can you tell us a little bit about divergent political attitudes, in particular as it regards Fidel Castro, of Oswald and Guy Bannister?
Well, as we mentioned earlier, much of the economic interest in New Orleans was Latin American trade, and a lot of that was focused on Cuba. When Castro took over Cuba, it cost people in New Orleans a lot of money. I mean, it disrupted their trade. Some people had oil refineries confiscated, oil wells confiscated, et cetera, in the process. There was a lot of real anger in the city of New Orleans about Castro. When Bannister came down, he made himself into a professional anti-communist and became a beacon of anti-communist sentiment in terms of trying to organize activities against Fidel Castro. At one point, in the summer of 1963, Bannister had organized a training camp across Lake Pontchartrain where they were actually training Cuban exiles for an assassination attempt on Fidel Castro. So it is very unusual that since Oswald has this public persona of being a member of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee and is cited as having been going around handing out leaflets on behalf of Castro, that we would find him associated with Bannister, who was training people with David Ferry, by the way, for an assassination attempt against Fidel Castro. So we have a direct contradiction here, which basically points out to the fact that we're looking at an intelligence game going on, and some of the things we're seeing on the surface are not really reflecting the reality underneath.
Bannister was also, as we mentioned earlier, the head of the Anti-Communist League of the Caribbean, an element of what later was to coalesce into the World Anti-Communist League that came into American public focus when the Iran-Contra scandal broke. We should note that some of the people involved with the conferences leading up to and of the eventual formation of the World Anti-Communist League are alumni of the various fascist powers of Europe from the World War II era. And I forgot the just offhand, the Bannister investigator, the name will come to me. One of his investigators discussed having allegedly channeled $100,000 in CIA money to the OAS in France to assassinate de Gaulle. This was the fellow who went out a hotel window in, I believe it was Panama or perhaps Mexico City.
I don't know his name, but Bannister was associated with a lot of those kind of activities.
It'll come to me. I'm just drawing a blank on that particular name. I know there was Hugh Ward, there was David Ferry, Jerry Brooks, Maurice Brooks Gatlin, that was the fellow.
Okay.
He was at one of the meetings that led to the formation of the WACL, along with former Goebbels propaganda man Fritz Kramer, spelled with a C, and former Nazi intelligencer named Hermann Punder, and other creatures of a similar political heritage. This by way of discussing some of the apparent fascist connections to the political, economic, and national security milieu that we're outlining. Again, Guy Bannister was also a fellow who published the Louisiana Intelligence Digest, which maintained that the American Civil Rights Movement was a communist conspiracy. The Clinton, Louisiana incident in which David Ferry, Lee Harvey Oswald, and Clay Shaw were seen together probably relates to the opposition on the part of Bannister to the American Civil Rights Movement. By the way, Alton Oxnard also shared those views, did he not?
Well, he opposed the civil rights. We have a letter from Alton Oxnard to one of his donors in which he outlines that he was completely against the civil rights amendment and actions that were passed by Kennedy during Kennedy's administration. So I think it's fair to say he was a segregationist, though it's difficult to know really how far he went down there. Above everything else, he was an anti-communist, and that was really where he positioned himself. But he was basically an antebellum, anti-liberal, anti-communist person who had a simplified view of the world and took extreme positions on just about everything.
We might also note that very same address in New Orleans that was later to house the Guy Bannister Detective Agency had been requisitioned by Sergio Arcacha Smith to house the Cuban Revolutionary Council, the CIA's umbrella organization that subsumed all of the various anti-Castro exile groups under its stewardship. Later Oswald employer William Riley was a major contributor to CRC in New Orleans. Now, Ed, you were working for an advertising firm, and on one of your assignments, you came across a fascinating connection linking the previously mentioned Ed Butler of Inca with the files of Guy Bannister. Tell us about that.
Well, first of all, I'm from New Orleans, which maybe is obvious at this point, but we haven't really stated it. I went to Tulane University, and in my 20s, I was working at an advertising agency in New Orleans on Lee Circle, which is part of St. Charles Avenue, which is really only two or three blocks from where Guy Bannister's office was. And that block is worth talking about because it also contained the Riley Coffee Company, where Lee Harvey Oswald worked. And right across the park, it's called Lafayette Park from there, was F. Edward Hebert's office, chairman of the U.S. House Representatives Armed Services Committee, who was responsible for hiding the CIA's budget in the U.S. military budget. Also within several blocks of there were the FBI offices, the CIA offices, and the Naval Intelligence offices. So that was sort of the intelligence community was right there about two or three blocks from my office.
Bear in mind that Lee Harvey Oswald supposedly had defected to the Soviet Union and was a pro-Castro activist, and yet hanging out with all of these dyed-in-the-wool anti-Castro, anti-communist individuals.
Well, one day in 1982, I went to work as usual, and I was called into one of my boss's offices, and he handed me a piece of paper with an address on it and told me to go talk to these people as a courtesy call for the agency. He really didn't explain to me who they were, what they wanted, and told me just to go handle it. So I got in the streetcar and went over to Canal Street and found this address. And when I got in there, I met some very bizarre people who were involved in very bizarre stuff. It was obviously a right-wing propaganda mill. This is where I met this man whose name is Ed Butler, and an older gentleman and a couple of doctors. And they were trying to resurrect this facility there, and they told me it was a radio station, which was not quite true, but it was involved in radio broadcast, and they showed me around the place. And what they were trying to do was to get me as a member of the advertising community to help them come up with a promotional plan to resurrect this anti-communist propaganda mill. I will emphasize that this is right when Ronald Reagan takes office, and it's right before all this Contra stuff happens down in Central America. So they're trying to warm up this organization. In the process of that, they're giving me a tour of the place, and they show me a set of files that they tell me belonged to Guy Bannister. And they ask me, and then they also tell me that they lost the indexing system, and they ask me if I would be willing to help them reconstruct the index on it. And so I looked at these files, and I really didn't know where I was at the time. I didn't really know who these people were. Specifically, I didn't know who was behind them. I didn't know all that stuff while I was there. I figured it out since. But I saw these very strange files, because if most people, when you look at a file, there's a name on it. Well, these files didn't have any names on them. They had numbers. It was all like 25-132. And the entire filing system, and there were four or five of these chest-high files in a row up against the wall, every single file in them was completely numeric, and you couldn't tell what was in what unless you had the indexing system. So I stopped and looked at the contents of some of these files, and they were all about communism and Central America, and they were from newspapers all over the South, Atlantic Constitution, things from Miami and Washington, D.C., and stuff. And it turns out that, you know, Guy Bannister, of course, an ex-FBI agent, used the FBI filing system, which was numeric. And you had to have the index in order to know what was in it, which, of course, means people could file and retrieve all day long without knowing what they're doing, which is a nice thing for an intelligence organization to have.
Sure.
But it wasn't until later that I understood that these files were stolen out of Guy Bannister's office after his death, and they had been the subject of a search by Jim Garrison during the JFK assassination investigation. And when I started researching where I was, and then I went back to New Orleans as I was a part of the investigation that Frontline did on Lee Harvey Oswald, I was hired by Frontline to go to New Orleans and check the situation out, I was able to prove that the place that I had seen Guy Bannister's files was in fact INCA, the Information Council for the Americas, which was founded and financed by Dr. Alton Ochsner, who was president of INCA, and that the man that had shown me the files was in fact Ed Butler, who was the executive director of INCA, who was the same person who had debated Lee Harvey Oswald and exposed his supposed defection to the Soviet Union.
Thus proving at least some sort of operational connection at some point between the Bannister milieu and that of Ed Butler and Alton Ochsner.
That's right. And then I got a hold of people like Jim DiEugenio with CITGA, the Citizens for Truth About the Kennedy Assassination.
And by the way, the author of a very fine book on the Garrison investigation called Destiny Betrayed, which
is
well worth reading.
Yes, a great book, and it was working with him that I was able to flush out the INCA aspect of this. And then he went down to New Orleans, and he actually went and interviewed people who were employees of Guy Bannister's detective agency, and this man's name is Alan Campbell, and asked him if he had ever seen Guy Bannister with Alton Ochsner. And the answer was yes. They had gone to dinner together, and there was some personal connection between there. And then another researcher by the name of Bill Davies sent me a document that he found in the National Archive, which was the minutes of, dig this, the National Security Committee of the New Orleans Chamber of Commerce, at which Alton Ochsner and Guy Bannister both attended, and Alton Ochsner and Ed Butler made a presentation against communism in Latin America.
Fascinating.
So there is clear evidence that Ochsner and Bannister were connected. Now, what's interesting is when you put an organizational chart up on the wall and you put Lee Harvey Oswald in the middle of it and you say, okay, up here on the top is all the overt things we know about, the TV and cameras coming out and filming him on the streets, the radio debates, all that stuff. And down on the bottom you put all the covert stuff, the secret stuff, his relationship with Guy Bannister, his relationship with Clay Shaw, his relationship with David Ferry. It turns out that that Alton Ochsner is the connection between all these people. He connects the overt and the covert sides of what was going on with Lee Harvey Oswald in New Orleans in the summer of 1963, and that in itself is extremely suspicious.
And more than a little important, Ochsner is an individual who, as I like to say on my program, had more connections than a switchboard. By the way, some of these same, as something of an aside, some of these same types of political connections were manifested by some of Ochsner's children. I believe it was his son, Arnold, although perhaps a different one, but there was a newsletter out of the American Southwest that discussed, I believe it was Arnold Ochsner, perhaps a different Ochsner, but I believe it was Arnold, the son of Alton, working with David Duke in order to raise funds with the Contras. Of course, Duke, the former American Nazi and Ku Klux Klansman, perhaps former, belongs in quotes. There are those who would make that statement. An individual of extremely reactionary stripe. I think someone who could be properly characterized as a fascist, although he might take issue with that, was working with one of the Ochsner progeny to raise money for the Contras.
Yes. in brief, yes. And let me annotate that with a couple of thoughts. One is shortly after the incident I just described about Inca and seeing Bannister's files, one of the Ochsner sons, who was himself 40 to 50, maybe even 60 years old at the time, started a organization which I believe is called the Caribbean League, which was specifically intended to raise money to support the Contras in fighting the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. They had an airplane and they flew supplies down. These were technically supposed to be non-lethal supplies, like no guns, but there are people involved in the operation who said, yes, there were guns, and they said it on television. And so there was a certain amount of that being continued on. One of the things that one must always keep in mind is that money and politics are very close to each other in New Orleans, and this whole anti-communist thing has an economic side to it. And one must remember that Ochsner Clinic made a lot of their money from the oligarchy of these Latin American countries coming up to their clinic, and they really supported visibly and vocally the anti-communist efforts of those oligarchies and participated in them, and it was both a political act out of ideology and a economic act to protect their clients from being overthrown.
Indeed, some of the alleged or real fascist connections that we've touched on also have anti-communism as the political cement that fuses this milieu. One of the most important people in your book, another prominent figure in American medicine, although someone who has been sadly overlooked, is Dr. Mary Sherman. She is the Mary of the title, Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, and she was one of the most prominent cancer researchers in the United States. Could you begin telling us something about her medical pedigree, so to speak?
Sure. The first thing I think we should say is that Mary Sherman worked for Alton Ochsner and worked directly for him and was a partner in his clinic, and that is a primary bit of information about her. But let me go back to her background for a minute. She is from Illinois. She went to the University of Chicago in the 30s. Now, at the University of Chicago in the 1930s is where Enrico Fermi first split the atom. They had a great atom smasher or circular accelerator underneath Wrigley Field there near the campus of the University of Chicago. So, and the University of Chicago, by the way, was founded by the Rockefellers as a research facility and was really the backbone of this whole biochemical knowledge in America. And the biochemical stuff went further into the atomic stuff, which is why they brought Fermi in. So Mary Sherman is there at the headwaters of nuclear knowledge and biochemical knowledge as she attends the medical school of the University of Chicago, which is a real intellectual power station. She tries to become a pediatrician, and just about the time she was doing that, her husband committed suicide, and she decided to go into orthopedic surgery and instead of pediatrics. Then in about 1952, she's brought down to New Orleans by Alton Ochsner. She is given a associate professorship at Tulane Medical School, and she runs a pathology lab, a cancer lab, bone pathology lab, at the Ochsner Clinic, where she is a partner. She becomes extremely successful in American medicine. She was technically an orthopedic surgeon, and if one is an orthopedic surgeon, the most elite organization you can belong to is the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons. And if you're a hitter in there, you get on a committee, and if you're a super hitter, you get on, you become a chairman of the committee. Well, Mary Sherman was the chairman of the pathology committee of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons, which made her simply one of the most respected people in American medicine. And for her to accomplish that in orthopedic surgery, which is a field which is a very male-dominated field, is a remarkable accomplishment.
As something of an aside, Ed, Mary Sherman, along with a couple of her colleagues, whom we will get to later on in our interview, Sarah Stewart and Bernice Eddy, I think might very well, or perhaps should, I don't want to sound didactic, become the focus of research by American feminists, because these were women who had risen to the very top or near the top of their fields within the practice of medicine, and indeed, as a trio, they, I think it could be fairly said, blazed the way for the research into virus-caused cancer at a time when women were basically supposed to be, you know, homemakers, sex objects, etc.
I agree with that completely. I consider these women to be on the level of somebody like Madame Curie in France, and had they been in a different country and at a different time, they would have gotten the recognition they deserved. And I look forward to our opportunity in a couple of minutes to really talk about them in detail. The thing I'd like to add about Mary Sherman is what was her professional expertise, and I have dug up many of her medical articles. And one of the things she was most expert in and was most published in was the effects of radiation on cancers.
Now we should also note, too, that Mary Sherman, again, a prominent cancer researcher, was working both at Tulane and also for the Ochsner Clinic. Now, interestingly enough, in the course of Jim Garrison's investigation, he turned up a connection between Dr. Mary Sherman and David Ferry. We're going to discuss this connection a little bit further, but with regard to David Ferry, we should perhaps fill in the audience a little bit. Many of the members of this audience are quite familiar with his position in the Garrison investigation, but David Ferry also was someone who was closely affiliated with Lee Harvey Oswald, apparently, at least to a certain extent over a period of years, and obviously Ferry figured in Jim Garrison's investigation. Could you tell us a little bit about Oswald, Ferry, the Garrison investigation, and how Ferry figures into this scenario?
Sure. Let me start with Ferry. Ferry is a personality of comic book proportions. I mean, he is a bizarre and erratic individual. Professionally, he was an airline pilot, and had his airline pilot status taken away from him due to an incident which I think really says a lot about his character. He was trying to impress a teenage boy, as he was always trying to do, and he was drunk, and he went and borrowed or stole an airplane off of the Lakefront Airport in New Orleans and flew over the city at treetop level, buzzing the whole city to entertain the boy. When he got back to the Lakefront Airport, the FAA officials were waiting for him, and they and as with the boy's parents, and they set in motion a chain of events which led to Ferry losing his job as an airline pilot. Once he lost that job, he drifted into the next circle of people, which is flying private missions for people, and wound up working for the Central Intelligence Agency, flying missions in and out of Cuba, and as well as training Cuban exiles as pilots for the Bay of Pigs invasion at a facility down in Guatemala.
He was also working for Guy Bannister, as well as New Orleans organized crime chieftain Carlos Marcello.
That is correct. And in fact, at the moment of the Kennedy assassination, Ferry was sitting in court with Carlos Marcello as part of his entourage. And then suddenly, after the court was dismissed, got in a car and drove over to Texas. It was the act of a pilot suddenly going over to Texas when the president was shot led Garrison to be very suspicious of David Ferry and discovered that he was associated with Oswald, and therefore when Ferry returned on Monday, November 25th, 1963, to New Orleans, Garrison picked up Ferry and turned him over to the FBI as a potential conspirator in the assassination.
By the way, people, listeners who have seen the movie JFK, David Ferry is a character played by Joe Pesci in that movie.
Right. The FBI, as shown in the movie, promptly released Ferry with what amounted to an apology and did nothing to further investigate his connection with Oswald, etc., or did very little.
Perry Russo, a witness in the Garrison investigation, we're almost at the end of this half-hour segment, alleged that Ferry and Clay Shaw and Lee Harvey Oswald and some Cubans were discussing the Kennedy assassination. Could you tell us about that in about 30 seconds or so?
Okay, well, Perry Russo was one of the young men who hung around David Ferry, and one night over at his place there was a party with a bunch of Cubans and Clay Shaw and Lee Harvey Oswald, and David Ferry got drunk and explained how Kennedy could be killed in the open with a triangulated crossfire. And Perry Russo, when Ferry was arrested, he came forward to protect himself, to tell Garrison that he had seen this conversation occur.
And we should also mention in closing this segment that David Ferry's association with Lee Harvey Oswald goes all the way back to when David Ferry was training young men, and I guess Oswald was about 16, for the Civil Air Patrol.
Yes, and he got fired from the Civil Air Patrol, too, for misconduct involving young men.
We are speaking with Ed Haslam, the author of Mary Ferry and the Monkey Virus, the story of an underground medical laboratory published in softcover by the Wordsworth Press, copyright 1995. In our next half-hour segment, we're going to join Ed and his fascinating story of the connection between, among other things, Mary Sherman and David Ferry. For Ed Haslam, this is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.